With you. Oh no, don't let it play. kiss me and you walked away. You were only 17. I never thought you'd act so mean, but baby, you told me you loved me.
Right. hope you're enjoying Elephant Candy by The Fun and Games at 78. We've been upping it every 30 seconds so that we hit our 4 p.m. finish time. This has been Record Roulette with DJ Sideways and Peachy, and we hope you have a wonderful afternoon.
It has been 37 days since Donald Trump took office. And a lot has been going on every single one of those 37 days. Yeah. And you could be feeling a lot of things about that. But more than anything, you might be feeling overwhelmed. But whatever you're feeling, I want you to know that you should never feel alone. So for the first 100 days, I'm going to be coming to you once a month with a general recap of how Americans are feeling, with polls and data provided by Navigator Research. So these posts will also be nonpartisan. I'm just going to give you a lay of the land. I always think it's important for you to be able to inform your own opinions and make your own judgment calls. And what better way to do that than discussing the relevant data? So without further ado, let's get into it. Need my notes. So as we know, it is tax season. Yeah, and we've heard a lot of things, whether it's about Donald Trump trying to get rid of the IRS and create an ERS, whatever that means. But more than anything, what we've heard from the White House is messaging that we'll provide more tax cuts to the rich and create cuts to programs that our taxes would typically fund that would benefit the middle and lower classes. Here's what Americans are saying. Trump's alignment with tech CEOs is concerning. Most people, 90%, want tax cuts for the middle class instead. 69% of Americans believe tech CEOs are influencing Trump's administration, and it's seen across all racial groups, 68% in white folks, 66% black, 76% Hispanic, AAPI 77%, so it's not even that. 41% of Americans think Trump will help his billionaire friends get richer instead of helping the middle class, and 80% of Americans say CEOs, billionaires, and foreign investors should not get tax cuts. And speaking of his allegiance to tech billionaires, Elon Musk, his numbers are also dipping as far as favorability. As I'm sure you know, once Trump was put in office, he gave Elon Musk a new department, a Department of General Efficiency, to which he was able to access Americans' private information, our Social Security, the Department of Education, Department of Treasury, and since has laid off several federal employees. And a number of federal programs, once again, have been taking funding cuts. And while he might have landed at a 47% in unfavorability in October of 2024, he's now at 53%, and that might not seem like a big jump, but generally Americans do not want tech billionaires calling shots or meddling in policy, period. Now, with all that said, basically Americans are feeling that Trump is focused on himself, doing what's best for himself. 53% of Americans feel that way. A lot of Americans feel like he's just bringing corruption to D.C., that whole the January 6th pardon. 48% of Americans do not like that or feel negatively about that. 44% of Americans feel negatively about the funding freeze. My biggest takeaway from all these numbers is that even though the election results would lead one to believe that the majority of Americans feel one way, as time passes for sure, discontent is brewing across Americans, regardless of race, class, gender, socioeconomic status, or any walk of life. So, yeah, we'll check back in next month. And if you feel like these numbers were helpful, please visit Navigator's Instagram and their website to see what poll information they have available to you now. Thank you.
You're not acting grateful enough. You're not being thankful. Donald Trump, to the leader of Ukraine. Joining our ongoing coverage, former United States Ambassador to the United Nations, former National Security Advisor to President Obama, Ambassador Susan Rice is here. Ambassador, your reaction.
Well, Nicole, obviously it's a very sad day and an embarrassment for the United States on the world stage. But let's step back and analyze what's happened here. I think there's no question that this was a setup. You heard Donald Trump say at the end of that clip you played, this is great television. This was a setup. Volodymyr Zelensky was compelled to agree to a horrible deal that would have sent Ukraine's minerals to the United States without any concrete security guarantees. And yet, because he was trying to improve a relationship with Donald Trump, he came to Washington, he came to the Oval Office, and sat down for a meeting, hat in hand. And soon after he got there, the vice president of the United States lit into him and started a confrontation. Now, I've been in countless Oval Office meetings with heads of state, presidents and vice presidents, as national security advisor, as UN ambassador, and in other roles. I can tell you that the vice president or the secretary of state or anybody else, they don't jump in, hijack a conversation without the express blessing of the president of the United States. So J.D. Vance did that deliberately. Donald Trump knew what he was going to do. And I think, as he said at the end, because he can't, you know, help himself, this was a setup for the cameras. It was a play to his base. But above all, it was a play to Vladimir Putin, to show fealty to Vladimir Putin, and to try to humiliate Zelensky. But Zelensky didn't play along with the script, because Zelensky's got dignity and guts, and Zelensky has people that he democratically represents. And as a result, he couldn't sit there in silence as lies were being told about how the war was started, whose responsibility it was, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And he tried to explain what is in fact the case. To suggest that he was not thankful, I can't count the number of times that Zelensky has thanked the American people, the American government, the President of the United States for the critical support that we've provided. It's not about gratitude. It was an effort to humiliate him, to scuttle the U.S.-Ukraine relationship so that Trump no longer feels any obligation to provide support and to hand U.S. interests and Ukraine and potentially Europe to Putin on a silver platter.
Why?
That's a great question.
Susan, we're gonna unfreeze you. I want to play some more of the president in the Oval Office if we have more of that. We're trying to Ambassador, you're unfrozen.
I hope so.
I say why, and I'll add this. Trump had so much to say about everything he and Putin had been through together. It was like a dictator's version of "We Can Do Hard Things." If you're familiar with that podcast, it was insane.
Yeah, Nicole, I think we have to understand that what happened today is really a piece of a larger puzzle. We've seen this building, frankly, since before Trump returned to office. But literally so much of what he has done in his first 5 weeks in office have been to the benefit of Russia and China. So let's review the bidding. You know, threatening our ally, Denmark and Greenland. You know, starting a trade war with our closest allies and partners, trying to, you know, create a conflict with Canada and trying to pretend to relegate it to the 51st state. Vance going to Munich and basically trying to blow up the NATO alliance, pulling the United States Agency for International Development 100% off the map and retreating. Proposing to cut 8% a year from the Department of Defense and literally dismantling the federal government and eviscerating it. That is not in any way, shape, or form in the national security interests of the United States. We are not only alone and alienated from our closest allies in Europe and Asia, as we heard from Turnbull, but worse, we have aligned ourselves completely with Russia, who is aligned with China, North Korea, and Iran. So in 5 weeks, we flipped the script, and we are dangerously isolated and cast our lot with adversaries who truly do not have our interests at heart.
I mean, Andrew Nastios, who was the head of USAID for George W. Bush, was on the program and made the argument that USAID keeps us safe from... It kept us safe from another 9/11 in the years after 9/11, because by stemming catastrophe and human suffering, you also counter extremism in some of the most brutal and hostile corners of the globe. That aid isn't just philanthropic, which seems to be Donald Trump's misunderstanding of it, that aid is one of our most mighty soft power tools, not just for ending human suffering, but for keeping us safe here. Another person described this as the worst 24 hours in modern American history, that we dismantle programs to spare children from dying of malaria and measles, mumps, preventable deaths and diseases, and we dismantle the World Alliance. What is Trump's end game if you're an adversary or an ally looking at everything he's doing?
I think his end game is to undermine the security and stability of the United States. And that brings us back to the question that you asked earlier. Why? There's no other way to look at this in sum, Nicole, than to see that this is a deliberate and comprehensive weakening of the United States in very short order, from a security point of view, from an economic point of view, from a diplomatic point of view, all to the benefit of our principal adversaries, Russia primarily, and China. And so I think the sooner the American people understand what this is about, what this is at what's at stake, the clearer we can be. Now, Vladimir Putin is not popular in the United States. 80% of Americans understand him to be the vicious, cruel dictator that he is. But I'd love to hear more than one Republican in Congress stand up and say that this is not who the United States is. This is not what we signed up for. And more importantly, this is not making America safer. It's, in fact, making us weaker and shrinking in the world. And it is going to make every American less safe.
I mean, before the Oval Office ambush, Republicans were on the record as recently as last week criticizing Putin, calling him what he is, and praising Zelensky. At least one Republican senator, I think it's Mr. Wicker, deleted a tweet today and got in line with almost the same. This is Senator Wicker, deleted a tweet highlighting the meeting with Zelensky and the bipartisan group of senators this morning, which he said went swimmingly. It went great. Zelensky was impressive and courageous and brave. And Democrats and Republicans left that meeting with high praise for Zelensky. He deleted this tweet praising Zelensky after Trump and Vance berated him in what you describe as a setup. What does that send to the world, that message?
Well, it's tragic. You know, Senator Wicker knows better. So do many of the senators on both sides of the aisle that participated in that meeting earlier.
There's that tweet up on the screen again. This was from this morning's. Republican Senator Wicker tweeted, "Today, several U.S. senators had the opportunity to meet with President Zelensky to discuss Ukraine's future and the mineral deal brokered by President Trump. This is a huge step forward in securing mutual prosperity and peace for Americans and Ukrainians." Senator Wicker tweeted that and then deleted it, Susan Rice.
And deleted it knowing better, as do so many of his Republican colleagues, as well as Democrats. And they are just kowtowing to a leader out of fear and cowardice and selling out the national interests in the process. I, you know, for all this talk we've heard for decades about how strong and muscular Republicans are on national security and defense, how they stand for freedom, as Ronald Reagan did, and up for democracy, they have just folded. And they are complicit in the undermining of our national security and our national interests.
What are your worries about what happens now? Now that Putin and Vance have done this, we're at the hinge point, right? It will forever be for Ukraine what happened before that meeting and what happens after. What is the risk now for the Ukrainian people?
Well, I worry about the Ukrainian people. I worry about Europe, and I worry about the wider world. For the Ukrainian people, they have no choice but to continue to do all that they can to defend themselves. They are facing an extremely powerful and hostile aggressor who now twice has invaded their country, and they're right to believe he'll do it again if given the opportunity. So they're going to have no choice except to continue to defend themselves. And one can hope that there might be some path to patching things up, but I think that's very hard to envision. I don't think Donald Trump wants that. I think he wants the outcome he got today. And that means that Europe and our other Democratic allies or erstwhile allies will need to do as much as they possibly can to continue to support Ukraine. People don't recall that Europe already has provided more billions more in assistance to Ukraine than the United States has, economic and military. They're going to need to continue to carry the load while the United States casts its lot with Vladimir Putin.
Hey, y'all, what's up? It has been 37 days since Donald Trump took office, and a lot has been going on every single one of those 37 days. Yeah, and you could be feeling a lot of things about that, but more than anything, you might be feeling overwhelmed. But whatever you're feeling, I want you to know that you should never feel alone. So for the first 100 days, I'm going to be coming to you once a month with a general recap of how Americans are feeling with polls and data provided by Navigator Research. So these posts will also be nonpartisan. I'm just going to give you a lay of the land. I always think it's important for you to be able to inform your own opinions and make your own judgment calls. And what better way to do that than discussing the relevant data? So without further ado, let's get into it. Need my notes. So as we know, it is tax season. Yeah, and we've heard a lot of things, whether it's about Donald Trump trying to get rid of the IRS and create an ERS, whatever that means. But more than anything, what we've heard from the White House is messaging that we'll provide more tax cuts to the rich and create cuts to programs that our taxes would typically fund that would benefit the middle and lower classes. Here's what Americans are saying. Trump's alignment with tech CEOs is concerning. Most people, 90%, want tax cuts for the middle class instead. 69% of Americans believe tech CEOs are influencing Trump's administration, and it's seen across all racial groups, 68% in white folks, 66% black, 76% Hispanic, AAPI 77%, so it's not even that. 41% of Americans think Trump will help his billionaire friends get richer instead of helping the middle class. And 80% of Americans say CEOs, billionaires, and foreign investors should not get tax cuts. And speaking of his allegiance to tech billionaires, Elon Musk, his numbers are also dipping as far as favorability. As I'm sure you know, once Trump was put in office, he gave Elon Musk a new department, a Department of General Efficiency, to which he was able to access Americans' private information, our Social Security, the Department of Education, Department of Treasury, and since has laid off several federal employees, and a number of federal programs, once again, have been taking funding cuts. And while he might have landed at a 47% in unfavorability in October of 2024, he's now at 53%, and that might not seem like a big drop, but generally Americans do not want tech billionaires calling shots or meddling in policy, period. Now, with all that said, basically Americans are feeling that Trump is focused on himself, doing what's best for himself. 53% of Americans feel that way. A lot of Americans feel like he's just bringing corruption to D.C., that whole the January 6th pardon. 48% of Americans do not like that or feel negatively about that. 44% of Americans feel negatively about the funding freeze. My biggest takeaway from all these numbers is that even though the election results would lead one to believe that the majority of Americans feel one way, as time passes for sure, discontent is brewing across Americans, regardless of race, class, gender, socioeconomic status, or any walk of life. So, yeah, we'll check back in next month. And if you feel like these numbers were helpful, please visit Navigator's Instagram and their website to see what poll information they have available to you now. Thank you.
You're not acting grateful enough. You're not being thankful. Donald Trump to the leader of Ukraine. Joining our ongoing coverage, former United States Ambassador to the United Nations, former National Security Advisor to President Obama, Ambassador Susan Rice is here. Ambassador, your reaction.
Well, Nicole, obviously it's a very sad day and an embarrassment for the United States on the world stage. But let's step back and analyze what's happened here. I think there's no question that this was a setup. You heard Donald Trump say at the end of that clip you played, this is great television. This was a setup. Volodymyr Zelensky was compelled to agree to a horrible deal that would have sent Ukraine's minerals to the United States without any concrete security guarantees. And yet, because he was trying to improve a relationship with Donald Trump, he came to Washington, he came to the Oval Office, and sat down for a meeting, hat in hand. And soon after he got there, the Vice President of the United States lit into him and started a confrontation. Now, I've been in countless Oval Office meetings with heads of state, presidents and vice presidents, as national security advisor, as UN ambassador, and in other roles. I can tell you that the vice president or the secretary of state or anybody else, they don't jump in, hijack a conversation without the express blessing of the president of the United States. So J.D. Vance did that deliberately. Donald Trump knew what he was going to do. And I think, as he said at the end, because he can't, you know, help himself, this was a setup for the cameras. It was a play to his base. But above all, it was a play to Vladimir Putin, to show fealty to Vladimir Putin, and to try to humiliate Zelensky. But Zelensky didn't play along with the script, because Zelensky's got dignity and guts, and Zelensky has people that he democratically represents. And as a result, he couldn't sit there in silence as lies were being told about how the war was started, whose responsibility it was, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And he tried to explain what is in fact the case. To suggest that he was not thankful, I can't count the number of times that Zelensky has thanked the American people, the American government, the President of the United States for the critical support that we've provided. It's not about gratitude. It was an effort to humiliate him, to scuttle the U.S.-Ukraine relationship so that Trump no longer feels any obligation to provide support and to hand U.S. interests and Ukraine and potentially Europe to Putin on a silver platter.
Why?
That's a great question.
Susan, we're gonna unfreeze you. I want to play some more of the president in the Oval Office if we have more of that. We're trying to Ambassador, you're unfrozen.
I hope so.
I mean, I say why, and I'll add this. Trump had so much to say about everything he and Putin had been through together. It was like a dictator's version of "We Can Do Hard Things." If you're familiar with that podcast, it was insane.
Yeah, Nicole, I think we have to understand that what happened today is really a piece of a larger puzzle. We've seen this building, frankly, since before Trump returned to office. But literally so much of what he has done in his first 5 weeks in office have been to the benefit of Russia and China. So let's review the bidding. You know, threatening our ally, Denmark and Greenland. You know, starting a trade war with our closest allies and partners, trying to, you know, create a conflict with Canada and trying to pretend to relegate it to the 51st state. Vance going to Munich and basically trying to blow up the NATO alliance. Pulling the United States Agency for International Development 100% off the map and retreating. Proposing to cut 8% a year from the Department of Defense and literally dismantling the federal government and eviscerating it. That is not in any way, shape, or form in the national security interests of the United States. We are not only alone and alienated from our closest allies in Europe and Asia, as we heard from Turnbull, but worse, we have aligned ourselves completely with Russia, who is aligned with China, North Korea, and Iran. So in 5 weeks, we flipped the script, and we are dangerously isolated and cast our lot with adversaries who truly do not have our interests at heart.
I mean, Andrew Nastios, who was the head of USAID for George W. Bush, was on the program and made the argument that USAID keeps us safe from... It kept us safe from another 9/11 in the years after 9/11 because by stemming catastrophe and human suffering, you also counter extremism in some of the most brutal and hostile corners of the globe. That aid isn't just philanthropic, which seems to be Donald Trump's misunderstanding of it, that aid is one of our most mighty soft power tools, not just for ending human suffering, but for keeping us safe here. Another person described this as the worst 24 hours in modern American history, that we dismantle programs to spare children from dying of malaria and measles, mumps, preventable deaths and diseases, and we dismantle the World Alliance. What is Trump's end game if you're an adversary or an ally looking at everything he's doing?
I think his end game is to undermine the security and stability of the United States. And that brings us back to the question that you asked earlier. Why? There's no other way to look at this in sum, Nicole, than to see that this is a deliberate and comprehensive weakening of the United States in very short order, from a security point of view, from an economic point of view, from a diplomatic point of view, all to the benefit of our principal adversaries, Russia primarily, and China. And so I think the sooner the American people understand what this is about, what this is at what's at stake, the clearer we can be. Now, Vladimir Putin is not popular in the United States. 80% of Americans understand him to be the vicious, cruel dictator that he is. But I'd love to hear more than one Republican in Congress stand up and say that this is not who the United States is. This is not what we signed up for. And more importantly, this is not making America safer. It's, in fact, making us weaker and shrinking in the world. And it is going to make every American less safe.
I mean, before the Oval Office ambush, Republicans were on the record as recently as last week criticizing Putin, calling him what he is, and praising Zelensky. At least one Republican senator, I think it's Mr. Wicker, deleted a tweet today and got in line with almost the same. This is Senator Wicker, deleted a tweet highlighting the meeting with Zelensky and the bipartisan group of senators this morning, which he said went swimmingly. It went great. Zelensky was impressive and courageous and brave. And Democrats and Republicans left that meeting with high praise for Zelensky. He deleted this tweet praising Zelensky after Trump and Vance berated him in what you describe as a setup. What does that send to the world, that message?
Well, it's tragic. You know, Senator Wicker knows better. So do many of the senators on both sides of the aisle that participated in that meeting earlier.
There's that tweet up on the screen again. This was from this morning's. Republican Senator Wicker tweeted, "Today, several U.S. senators had the opportunity to meet with President Zelensky to discuss Ukraine's future and the mineral deal brokered by President Trump. This is a huge step forward in securing mutual prosperity and peace for Americans and Ukrainians." Senator Wicker tweeted that and then deleted it, Susan Rice.
And deleted it knowing better, as do so many of his Republican colleagues, as well as Democrats. And they are just kowtowing to a leader out of fear and cowardice and selling out the national interests in the process. For all this talk we've heard for decades about how strong and muscular Republicans are on national security and defense, how they stand for freedom, as Ronald Reagan did, and up for democracy, they have just folded. And they are complicit in the undermining of our national security and our national interests.
What are your worries about what happens now? Now that Putin and Vance have done this, we're at the hinge point, right? It will forever be for Ukraine what happened before that meeting and what happens after. What is the risk now for the Ukrainian people?
Well, I worry about the Ukrainian people. I worry about Europe, and I worry about the wider world. For the Ukrainian people, they have no choice but to continue to do all that they can to defend themselves. They are facing an extremely powerful and hostile aggressor who now twice has invaded their country, and they're right to believe he'll do it again if given the opportunity. So they're going to have no choice except to continue to defend themselves. And one can hope that there might be some path to patching things up, but I think that's very hard to envision. I don't think Donald Trump wants that. I think he wants the outcome he got today. And that means that Europe and our other Democratic allies, or erstwhile allies, will need to do as much as they possibly can to continue to support Ukraine. People don't recall that Europe already has provided more, billions more in assistance to Ukraine than the United States has, economic and military. They're going to need to continue to carry the load while the United States casts its lot with Vladimir Putin.
Give my all. You can see the WRCT 88.3 FM. My name's Anthony Cachado, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Now, before we get into the mix of things today, just wanted to let you guys know that everything that you're going to hear today is strictly the opinions of myself and my guests today, and don't necessarily represent the views of WRCT. We're back. We're actually doing new episodes. I promise this is a thing. We're making it happen. And we have a guest today. We're actually talking about something interesting, or a couple interesting things today. We have a longtime friend of mine hailing from Texas. We have Gavin here with us today.
Texas experienced its worst blackout in state history. But there's one factor that never got much attention.
Natural gas failed in a big way.
The gas system that feeds many power plants simply didn't work. But why?
There's no plausible explanation for it other than a manipulation of price and a manipulation of supply.
Season 3 of The Disconnect, Power, Politics, and the Texas Blackout is out now. Find it at KUT.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
My family had the most effect on my becoming a journalist. I came from a family of serious-minded scholars. I have five brothers and sisters, all of whom are holders of advanced degrees in one field or another. One of my brothers is a holder of two earned PhD degrees. So as you can see, ours is a family heavily oriented toward education and service. I grew up wanting most of all to write and spent most of my childhood experimenting with writing, and concluded that it was the world for me. I saw so much that I thought needed to be described, communicated, explored, explained, and so forth. So that just became my outlet.
The late Robert C. Maynard, journalist, newspaper publisher, editor, and former owner of the Oakland Tribune newspaper. Maynard was a charismatic leader who changed the face of American journalism and built a four-decade career on the cornerstone of editorial integrity, community involvement, improved education, and the importance of the family. He was also co-founder of the Institute for Journalism Education, a nonprofit corporation dedicated to expanding opportunities for minority journalists at the nation's newspapers. In the 1980s, Maynard began a twice-weekly syndicated newspaper column in which he transformed national and international issues into dinner table discussions of right and wrong. When he bought the Oakland Tribune in 1983, he became the first African-American in this country to own a major daily newspaper. But Maynard had a career full of firsts, from being the first African-American national newspaper correspondent to being the first African-American newspaper editor-in-chief. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, The Life and Legacy of Robert C. Maynard in Black America.
Before I go on to say how that particular movement affected me personally, I want to say something about our profession that I think is an indictment of sorts. You know, we still have a ways to go toward full equality for blacks in America. But I think it's unfortunate that our media has not made it clear to the American people that what happened between 1950 and 1980, let's say, in America, 30 years, is probably one of the most phenomenal revolutions that's occurred in human history. To take the condition that blacks were in those days and to see the number of barriers that fell and the number of conditions that changed and the number of opportunities that present themselves today versus in that day. And it's a remarkable march, and black Americans should take greater pride in what we have already accomplished. That does not mean we should slacken in what we feel we need to continue to accomplish, but we should not allow ourselves, or deny ourselves, I should say, we shouldn't deny ourselves a justly deserved compliment
The late Robert C. Maynard was a dynamic leader in American journalism throughout the 1970s and 1980s. He was the first African American to own a major metropolitan daily newspaper. Maynard was the publisher of the struggling Oakland Tribune from 1983 until 1992. Through that newspaper and the Institute for Journalism Education, which he co-founded in 1976, he became instrumental in training and placing minority journalists in important positions nationwide. Born on June 17, 1937 in Brooklyn, New York, Maynard was the son of immigrants from Barbados. Interested in writing at an early age, he frequently cut class at Boys High School to hang out at the editorial office of a black weekly newspaper, the New York Age. In 1967, Maynard was hired by the Washington Post as national correspondent, the first African-American to hold that position on any major newspaper. In 1977, he left the Washington Post and moved to the University of California, Berkeley, to found the Institute for Journalism Education. In 1979, he was hired by Gannett as editor in the newly acquired Oakland Tribune newspaper. When he purchased the Oakland Tribune in 1983, he became the first African-American in this country to own a major daily newspaper. In 1985, Maynard was the recipient of the Whit Carter Reddick Award from the College of Communication at the University of Texas at Austin.
Langston had just put on a play called Simple Sings the Blues. And Jimmy Baldwin was just about to publish Notes of a Native Son. This was a period in Afro-American history that I was privileged to be the witness to, which was the moral preparation for the civil rights movement. That's what was going on in the middle to late 50s when I was traveling among this group of writers. They were raising the moral questions that would set the stage for Martin Luther King, for Malcolm X, and for the whole struggle that then ensued. The history of the movement up to that time is important to keep in context. Let me just go back 100 years. At the end of the Civil War, there was an attempt to bring blacks into some sort of economic participation and political participation in the South through Reconstruction, as it was called. Reconstruction collapsed in about the 1880s, and little by little, black people slipped into a status of semi-servitude. Yes, no longer slaves, but no, not quite free. And in that context came along a Supreme Court ruling called Plessy versus Ferguson, which decreed that as long as the state provided equal facilities for blacks, they could be separate. And that doctrine, separate but equal, is what prevailed from 1896 to 1954. Now, separate but equal was just a code word for segregation of the rankest sort. There was nothing the least bit equal about the treatment of blacks and whites in the South at that time. During World War II, black Americans went off, as you know, and distinguished themselves in war and died fighting for the freedom of this country. It was the people who came home in 1945, having fought and bled and seen their buddies die for democracy and freedom elsewhere, who began to plot the course for the overthrow of Plessy. They were lawyers primarily, you know, people who went to law school and set up shop at Howard University and used that as the launching pad for this assault on the second-class status of blacks in America. And as that battle began to heat up in the middle 50s, young writers and established writers began to try to